Adonai ma'adam vatedaehu. O Lord, what is man that thou art mindful of him? O Lord, what is man? One of the great poet philosophers of the Bible asked that question many centuries ago. In answering this question, he formulated the traditional doctrine of man according to our faith. O Lord, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And the son of man that thou thinkest of him, yet thou hast made him but little lower than the angels, and thou hast crowned him with glory and with honor. Man is physically limited, but creatively infinite. His body cannot move beyond his time and his place, but his spirit and his mind and his creative capacity can overleap and soar above his own immediate situation and reach out and grasp for the infinite. Adonai ma'adam, O Lord, what is man? Recently, in a much more limited sense, this question has again been asked. It has been asked not by poet philosophers, but by sociologists, critics of the social scene, by historians, by psychiatrists. And the answer which they give to this question is by no means as noble a picture of man as that given by the Bible. Recently, there has been a surprising spate of research on the status of the American male. The answers derived by some of these thinkers will, I believe, surprise you. The French novelist and critic, Monsieur Emery de Riencourt, in a visit to America, observed that the most startling thing of the scene on the American situation was simply this, that he felt that today, and I quote, the American male was an oppressed minority. Look magazine recently commissioned J. Robert Moskin to do a series of feature articles on the status of the American male. And the gist of this report can be understood from the opening sentence. The scientists of the human situation believe that the American male is today dominated by the American female. The eminent anthropologist and thinker Margaret Mead recently completed some years of study of the American home, and she summarized and capsulized her thinking in a survey which was published under the title, The American Man in a Woman's World. Social critics have made a great deal of the perhaps not unsurprising popularity of that story, familiar to many of us last year, of a man who boasted himself that in his family he made all the important decisions. And when the friends of his wife taxed her upon this claim, she said, yes, that is true. Henry decides whether the People's Republic of China shall be admitted to the United Nations, and how much economic aid shall be given to India, and I decide when we need a new car, and when furniture should be bought for the living room. There's a great deal of this literature. Perhaps it was best summarized by that brilliant young historian, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who in an article on the decline of American masculinity asked the question of the Bible author, what is man, and made these observations. What has happened to the American male? For a long time, he seemed utterly confident in his manhood, sure of his masculine role in society, easy and definite in his sense of sexual identity. The frontiersmen of James Fenimore Cooper, for example, never had any concern about masculinity. They were men, and did not occur to them to think twice about it. Even well into the 20th century, the heroes of Dreiser, of Fitzgerald, of Hemingway remain men. But one begins to detect a new theme emerging in some of these authors, especially in Hemingway. The theme of the male hero increasingly preoccupied with proving his virility to himself. And by mid-century, the male role had plainly lost its rugged clarity of outline. Today, men are more and more conscious of maleness, not as a fact, but as a problem. The way by which American men affirm their masculinity are uncertain and they are obscure. There are multiplying signs, indeed, that something has gone badly wrong with the American male's conception of himself. On the most superficial level, the roles of male and female are increasingly merged in the American household. The American man is found as never before as a substitute for wife and mother, changing diapers, washing dishes, cooking meals, and performing a whole series of what once were considered female activities. The American woman, meanwhile, takes over more and more of the big decisions, controlling them indirectly when she cannot do so directly. Outside the home, one sees a similar blurring of function. While men design dresses and brew up cosmetics, women become doctors, lawyers, bank cashiers, and executives. Dr. Bruno Bettelheim, the psychologist, writes, "Women now fill many masculine roles and expect their husbands to assume many of the tasks once reserved for their own sex," unquote. They seem an expanding, aggressive force, seizing new domains like a conquering army, while men, more and more on the defensive, are hardly able to hold their own and gratefully accept assignments from their new rulers. A recent book bears the stark and melancholy title, The Decline of the American Male. Most of us, when we read these essays and analyses of the American male, do so indulgently. Cynics have been telling us that the male was on his way to extinction as the dominant species ever since Eve first induced or enticed Adam to eat of the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden. American humor has long since indulgently played upon the battle of the sexes. Mr. James Thurber, for instance, has been giving tongue-in-the-cheek advice to both contestants, and all of us cherish his advice to the young bride, that wives should be careful to cultivate the illusion, careful to cultivate the illusion of freedom in the American husband, that he is able to come and go when he wishes. He should have that opportunity. That if a husband uses by mistake the guest towel, the wife should be careful not to send him from the room. But what is surprising about these new criticisms of the American male is that they are deadly serious. They're not done out of any sense simply of passing off lightly a subject of some interest. These critics, for the most part, feel that there is something definitely out of balance in the American home. They point to the rise of divorce, to the increase of delinquent behavior, to the increase of alcoholism and other forms of addiction, to the rapid rise of emotional disturbance and of suicide and of mental breakdown. And they say that at least some of these disturbing factors in the American home are directly tied to the lack of a stable, strong, respected father, authoritarian in his control and dominant in his position. A respected father, they say, would enforce a standard of discipline, a code of morals. He would not allow some of this excessive permissiveness which they feel has undermined the American character. They feel that the American family has been excessively concerned with questions of status, with things, with keeping up with the Joneses, with gossip. And they feel that a strong father figure in the home would focus again the interests of the home upon questions of values, upon ideas and ideals and basic loyalties. The father to these critics represents strength. A fine central balance which gives meaning and direction to the family and which can successfully pilot the vessel of family life out of roiling stormy waters. Has then the status of the American male declined? To measure such a subject quantitatively is, of course, impossible. And yet were we to look at the American home 50 years ago and again today, I think we will see that there has been a striking change in method of operation and in stratification in organization. Many of you will, I am sure, recall that very pleasant bit of theater written by Mr. Clarence Day, which was called Life with Father. It depicted a typical American home at the turn of the century, middle income, middle class, happy, strong, and stable. Father was the center of that home. The home revolved around his will and his wishes. The home was truly a life with Father. His business requirements determined the use of the family carriage. His daily schedule set the dining hours. No one thought of violating the peace of his after-dinner hour with a brandy and with the evening paper. His decisions were never challenged, at least publicly. The dining room table never became a debating society in which young and old argued the merits of family policy. The father was master of his castle. This was his refuge, and he rejoiced there in the affection of his family and as the center of attention of their interests. Now, every family unit is sui generis, is unique unto itself. Every man and every woman in each marriage has developed their own modus vivendi, their own way of life. And yet I think that we can picture a not atypical modern American home, and perhaps slightly exaggerating its outlines can see the direction in which change has taken place. For today's home is not father-centered, but family-centered, and often child-centered. Breakfast takes place when it fits the needs of all, usually at the hour when children need to be up and on their way to school. And dinner is served early because the maid wants the evening off. Father, on his way to school, on his way to work, must stop off to take the children at school. He must leave work in time to pick up the children at some after-school class. The evening paper is not read in the quiet of the living room after the dinner meal, but in the bedroom, late at night, after a last restless child has been brought a final cup of water, and after the last of the dinner dishes have been rinsed and washed and put away. Family decisions are precisely that, no longer obiter dictus handed down by an authoritarian father, but the results of family councils, and there is much pro and con and give and take and debate on every matter. Everyone in the family feels that he has a call on the family car and on the family budget and on the family schedule. And these are sufficiently flexible so that everyone feels that it is tailored to meet his needs. In the modern American family, there is a great deal of rudimentary democracy. Everyone has gained more freedom in the modern American family except the father. Has the American male lost in status? Yes, he has. And I would add that he should have. Because authoritarian family living is as outmoded and as outdated in the 20th century as authoritarian government. We know now that the farmer's son is as capable of casting an intelligent ballot as the nobleman's son. And that when he has been educated, he is as capable of dispensing the powers of government as anyone born to the purple. And similarly, we know that we husbands have sometimes difficulty in admitting it, that our wives are as wise and as understanding, and yes, quietly we'll whisper it, that they have as much common sense as we do, and that they are as capable of directing and managing family affairs and of making family policy decisions as we. We recognize today that marriage is a contract, a partnership between equals, not an act of submission. We recognize that a successful family requires the energies of two hearts and of two minds and of four pairs of hands. Yes, the American male has lost in status, but he lost a status that he should have lost long since. But this is not really the claim which is made by the critics of the American scene. They go further. They say that the American man is today led about by an invisible thread attached from his nose and controlled by his wife. That his decisions, his leisure time, his activities, his work are conditioned, determined, if you will, by her wishes and her will, that he has no will of his own. And they make this claim on the basis of several factors in the American society. Recently, a survey discovered that 80% of the leisure time of the man is controlled by the wishes of the woman. It is she who determines what plays will be seen, what symphonies will be attended, what television programs will be watched. It is she who determines which parties will be attended and which circle of friends the family will cultivate. Mr. Walt Disney made this interesting observation. He said that he always directed his pictures and his television programs to the women. For he said, they are the masters of the television set. They are the theater goers. They badger their husbands until they go along with them. If they are satisfied with my programs, then to heck with the male. Recently, Fortune magazine published this interesting statistic. 60% of all purchases in America are made by women. And of the remaining 40%, most are influenced, deeply influenced by the woman. Fortune pointed out that even some such seemingly masculine items as cars, furnaces, cigars, that the manufacturers of these items gear most of their advertising budget to the distaff side, because if they can convince the women of the need of a powder blue car, then the family will own a powder blue car. It is on evidence such as this that these critics of the American scene bespeak the man ruled by a legion of petticoats. Can we admit that this analysis is a correct one? I do not believe so. There have been strong-willed women and weak men from time immemorial. There are certainly men today whose lives are filled with the badgering of their wives, who allow themselves to be trampled upon and trodden down by the will of their women. Each of us has been in homes where the husband had to spend his free weekends running 100 errands that the wife could as easily have run during the work week. Each of us has been with families where the husband meekly assented to whatever the woman determined to do. Each of us has been with couples where the wife was allowed to spend whatever met her fancy without thought to the family budget or the family needs. And each of us has seen women who were more preoccupied with themselves and their persons and with their homes, who were always ready to set themselves down at a card table, but who were seldom ready to set the family down at the dinner table. Women who could not allow their husbands a much-needed evening of quiet and leisure to refresh themselves after a hard day's work, but who were always prodding and badgering their husbands to be up and to be doing, to be running to an endless, futile, folly-filled round of parties and diversions. Each of us have seen such marriages. They are the result of needless and foolish acceptance and acquiescence on the part of the man. And they are the result of needless and foolish demands on the part of the woman. But I do not think, looking about me at the American home, that they represent a cross-section, the majority, a or even a significant minority of American homes. From what I have seen, most American couples are determined to share the labor of family living. They are seeking to work out in a very changing, kaleidoscopically changing society, the balance of obligation, of responsibility, which is required to meet family obligations. They are intelligent about it. I think that possibly the greatest area of misgiving and a mistake occurs in one respect, and it is this. A wife wears one hat, a husband two. A wife is housemaker, mother. A husband is house owner, house helper, but he is also provider. He has a vocation, a profession, a business outside the home. His interests are not confined to the four corners of the family domicile and to the four sections of the family lot. A husband has interests outside the home, and sometimes he must expend prodigious amounts of time to cultivate his professional competency to achieve in his given business enterprise. There are weeks sometimes, and there are months, and sometimes even years, when the husband cannot assume any major sense of responsibility in the home, where the intelligent wife knows that she must take in the slack. For even in our very modern society, a woman's fundamental, primary, and essential responsibility is her home and her family. Modern society gives her a great deal of free time when her children are of school age and later when they have graduated into adult life. She will have an opportunity, as she had before marriage, to engage in business, to fulfill her talents and her interests. But once she determines that she wishes to marry and she wishes to raise her family, then she ought to take to heart the wisdom of the book of Proverbs, the wisdom of the wife is towards her home, and the foolish woman destroys, tears down her home with her own hands. The foolish woman is the woman who does not center every bit of energy, every power of concentration at her disposal in making of her a success of her marriage and of her family. She is the woman who today dissipates her energies in 1,000 vain pursuits, becomes too quickly tired of the tedium and the routine of homemaking, and forgets that marriage is a double responsibility, that she bears the fundamental root responsibility of keeping the home running like a well-oiled machine, of keeping the children clothed and happy, of keeping her husband healthy and content. This is the fundamental and essential responsibility of a woman today. What is the fundamental and essential responsibility of the modern American male? I would draw out this responsibility to you by an illustration. Our Bible contains one of the most brilliant panegyrics in praise of woman ever written. In the book of Proverbs, there is that beautiful poem, "A woman of valor who can find her praise is far above rubies. The heart of her husband does safely trust in her, and he has no lack of gain. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life." And then for verse after verse, it goes on to picture and portray the virtues that make for the beauty of this woman. And these virtues are the virtues of wife and of mother. She looks well to the way of her household. Her hand is always at the weaving. She makes coverlets for her house. The garments of her household are cared for. These are her virtues, the virtues of motherhood and the virtues of housemaker. And it is interesting to note that the Bible, no place, paints, poetically or otherwise, a picture of the man of valor. It never describes the essential area of his activity, for a man's activities are much more diverse, widespread, than those of the woman. For a man must reckon with this fundamental fact, that his home is only as secure as his community is secure and as his nation is secure. that his home will only be as healthy as his community is healthy, that his children will only be raised in as wonderful a world as his nation can provide for them. And so he has an obligation not only to provide and to sustain and to support the home, but to support all good causes in his community, to encourage the attainment of justice and of peace and of a better society in his world. For ultimately, no single home can withstand the tidal wave of social upheaval. And unless each husband, and later perhaps joined by his wife when she has the free time, unless each husband bestirs himself in community good, in programs of social activity, unless he seeks to encourage the economic well-being of his community, unless he seeks to establish justice in the gates, unless he seeks to establish peace among men, and unless, together with other fathers and husbands, he succeeds in these tasks, he will have defaulted on one of the primary responsibilities of husband and of father. For the responsibilities of the husband are to the home, and they are beyond the home. And the understanding wife will recognize that the husband has interests which will take him inevitably out of daily contact with the home. And she will make it inevitably responsible for her to undertake added responsibility towards the house and towards her family. Margaret Mead wrote these lines, and I commend them to you. Traditionally, women are as the custodians of home and child, have been a conservative force worrying about exposure to poverty, physical hardship, danger, and shipwreck. Yet today, men refuse international jobs because the climate of living for their children will not be admirable. They refuse assignments to public service committees where they are sorely needed because such assignments would spoil their weekends with their families. There are many commentators who will describe all this as a victory for women, now that they have their men where they want them as dishwashers, babysitters, companions, and escorts, docilely dashing for the suburban train and slaving their lives away to give their wives every luxury. For what? So that they can die, as embittered young men say over their beer 5 years earlier, and leave their wives to the ineffable delights of lonely but well-heeled widowhood. The only way to break this deadlock is to reinstitute the range of ideals without which any civilization perishes. Home and family are good things in which to raise children, but they are not the end-all and the be-all of every human being in our society. Home and the family are good things in which to rear children, but they are not the end-all and the be-all of every human being in this society. O Lord, what is man? Man is a frail, fragile creature of clay. We must somehow create a world of peace, concord, humanity, and justice. What is man? Man is a frail, fragile piece of clay who must somehow intelligently divide his energies between responsibilities to his world, responsibilities to his family, responsibilities to himself. Lord, what is man? Man is a fragile piece of clay who lives but 24 hours in each day, who needs part of each day to refresh his spirit, who must work out for himself in this changing world a new role and a new status. He will need help. He will need the help of wives and of children who will understand the extent of the responsibilities which lie heavily upon his shoulders. But he is not dominated, nor is he submissive. For man today, my friends, understands full well the extent of his duty, and he is grand, not little, in his endeavors to fulfill that responsibility. O Lord, what is man? Man is but little lower than the angels. He is crowned, if he will crown himself, with glory and with honor. Amen.